Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on lies my teacher told me right after this. You know, we Americans today are interrogated, watched, measured, and counted more than at any time in our history. This surveillance and electronic record keeping of nearly every routine activity, from bank deposits to medical visits, has produced greater efficiency and security, all right. But it's also responsible for a very discernible erosion of our ability to live our lives free from outside scrutiny. Now, the federal government currently maintains an average of 15 files on every American, according to estimates by the Office of Management and Budget. But closer to home, our state and local governments also use computers to keep their own files on us. And a study conducted by the New York Committee on Open Government found that that state, New York, and its agencies operated 1,776 separate data systems containing 10,799 categories of information about New York residents, and each one of those systems contained between 2 and 10 million records. Now, information about you is gained from 63 sources, and this information is gathered and stored in a very reasoned and logical manner for later retrieval and use. Now, would you like to know how your government, your bank, your insurance company, and how industry obtains all of this information about you? Well, what are their sources? How is it stored? How is it retrieved? What do they want it for? Knowing how this information is being gathered, and knowing what information is being stored, and knowing what information you want to keep personal and private, actually puts you in the driver's seat in your quest for privacy. Now, if you'd like more information about privacy and privacy issues, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967 and ask for our free general law CD package. And let me tell you how to train yourself to be just as personal and just as private as you want to be. Now, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. That number again, 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Just send us an email. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine when you get there and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget. All right, we've been talking about lies that our teachers tell us. Now, the teachers probably don't mean to lie to you. And I remember in the 10th grade, I was really excited. It was 10th grade history. It was ancient history. And, you know, up until the 10th grade, I'd been getting little bits and pieces of history. You know, we get a little bit of American history, and then we get a little bit of world history, and we get a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and I never could put it all together. It was just little snips and pieces and parts of the story. But when I got to the 10th grade, ancient history, I thought, now this is where it starts. We're going to go back to Genesis 1, and we're going to start with the creation. That's about as ancient as you can get, isn't it? And we're gonna find out about God making the heavens and the earth, and then we're gonna find out what Cain and Abel did, and then what their children do, and then that led us up to the flood, and then from the flood, you know, what happened after the flood and Noah and, you know, the Tower of Babel and all this. Because, you know, you went to Sunday school and you heard those stories. And then you went to public school. Of course, I went to parochial school, and so they kind of tied that story together. Then when I went into the public school system, God, I just it was like night and day. All of a sudden, God disappeared. There was no God. And we learned about evolution. Now all of a sudden, we've got evolution coming into the mix. Now I was really confused. Now all of a sudden, 10th grade, now we're going to straighten this out. So I opened up the book, and it started with a guy named Nebuchadnezzar about the 5th century, I guess, 6th century B.C. Nebuchadnezzar, 500 B.C. Well, I'd already heard about Solomon and King David, 1000 B.C. I'd already heard about Moses, you know, 1300 B.C. I'd heard about Job and the pyramids and the Egyptians, 2000, 3000 B.C., and so I thought starting history with Nebuchadnezzar was a little late in the game. So Mr. Shalinas, our history teacher, I asked him about this. And then he gave me some of this doublespeak. I don't know what he said exactly, but you know how people are when they don't want to tell you the truth. They start talking. And they talk, and they talk, and they talk, and they talk. And they don't say anything, but they're talking. You hear all these words, but there's no meaning. And so I listened to this, and he told me about Nebuchadnezzar and about how, you know, blah, blah. And so I said, but what about going back to the Garden of Eden? What about starting at the very beginning? What about getting back, you know, ahead of Nebuchadnezzar and starting, you know, in a chronological order and then bringing us up to today? And he got kind of frustrated with me, and he said, Gordon, the history book starts with Nebuchadnezzar, this class starts with Nebuchadnezzar, and you are going to start world history with Nebuchadnezzar. God, I felt like Galileo, you know, or Leonardo da Vinci in their confrontation with the Catholic Church and the Catholic hierarchy. You know, this is the way it is. The world is flat. And the world, the sun circles around the earth. You know, there's a mindset out here. There's politically correct. And at the time, you know, when the Catholic Church said that the sun circles around the earth, by God, that's politically correct. And you better believe it like everybody else. I forgot who it was now. Galileo, I think, said it was as he walked out of the hearing. He said, that may be official dogma, but nevertheless, the earth revolves around the sun. And that's the reality of it. That's where the truth is. Now, you people can believe whatever the hell you want, but that's not the truth. So in the book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, he's taking it up, and it's not politically correct. So if you want a politically incorrect book, this is one of them. I rate books, you know, like about a 1 in 20 or a 1 in 100. Well, this is about a 1 in 20 read. There's a lot of books out there that expose the lies that are going on around us. It isn't a blockbuster, you know, that you have never heard or seen this before. Hell, there's lots of books out there that talk about the lies that our teachers told us. But this just happens to be a neat one. A good one. So I'm going to rate it about a 1 in 20 book. And I think you can get a copy at Barnes & Noble. Now, if you find that you can't get it there for some reason, hell, it may be on the politically incorrect list. Remember our friends down at the Brave New Bookstore in Austin, Texas? They'll get it for you. BraveNewBookstore.com. It's an easy one. BraveNewBookstore.com. Or you can call them. It's easy to call. Just pick up the telephone and hit 512. That's the area code, 512-480-2503. Once more, that's 510-480-2503, and that'll get you hooked up to the Brave New Bookstore. They're in Austin, Texas. And if you live in Austin and you're down there close by, it's at 1904 Guadalupe Street, Suite B. is right next to the University of Texas campus there in Austin, 1904 Guadalupe Street, Suite B, Austin, Texas, 78705, in case you want to write them a letter. Zip code 78705, and they'll get hold of these politically incorrect books. So when you hear me tell you about a book and you can't find it anywhere, well, there's the source for politically incorrect books. Now, this is one of those politically incorrect books. You're not supposed to know this. So let's take a look here on page 87. Let's take a look at the first Thanksgiving. You know, this Thanksgiving Day. Now, I'm not opposed to Thanksgiving Day. Give thanks to who? President Bush? See, you Americans, you know, have a split personality. You have this thing called separation of church and state. God help you if you mention God or pray in your public school. And then you have this Thanksgiving Day, for which you take off a day and you go practice Thanksgiving Day. It's a holiday. Who are you giving thanks to? Well, the history of it is you're giving thanks to God, the Creator, for giving you this turkey dinner, for giving you all of these blessings that you have. It isn't authorized by God. He didn't tell you to do that at all. It's just something that we came up with and thought, well, it would just be a good idea for us to thank God for having given us all of these neat blessings. And so, over the years, we came up with this concept of a Thanksgiving Day. And so, the history of it, when I went to public school, was the very first Thanksgiving Day was done by the Pilgrims back in 1621. They arrived in 1620, and their very first harvest, 1621, they sat down with the Indians, and they just had a wonderful time, and they thanked God, and thanked the Indians, and Thanksgiving was just, they had turkey and sweet potatoes and all. That was the story I was told when I went to public school, and I believed it. And why wouldn't I? Mrs. Sorensen was a sweet lady. My first grade teacher told me about Thanksgiving, why we do that. And then we put turkeys up in the school windows, and we decorated for Thanksgiving. That was in the days before we threw God out of the public schools. That was before 1950. And so we didn't have any problems with God being in the public school in 1945, but, you know, since then we have a real problem with God. So we've decided to throw his hiney right out of our public schools, and we have. But we still practice Thanksgiving. Now, you know, I don't know if you're going to thank Nancy Pelosi or Harry Reid or Dick Cheney or George Bush or somebody, but I guess we're not supposed to thank God. We're supposed to thank our political leaders, maybe, or maybe our religious leaders, or maybe our economic leaders on Wall Street, you know, for Henry Paulson and Ben Bernanke or somebody for giving us all these great blessings, you know, like a meltdown of the world's economic system, or a new war, potential new war over in Georgia or Kosovo or someplace. All right, I'm being a little sarcastic here, but, you know, if you're going to practice Christmas, you know, the birthday of Jesus, don't you think you ought to have a little history of Jesus in your curriculum? Now, if on the other hand, we all evolved from green algae, and that's the official doctrine, well, then there isn't any God, and Jesus is a fiction, isn't he? And so here we take off a week for Christmas, 10 days, and well, you take off for Christmas and New Year's, and you're celebrating Thanksgiving Day, which are religious in nature, which are periods of time that you set aside to reflect upon the history of God and God's intervention or God's participation in history. History is man's story. It's the story of man. It is his, man's story. His story. History. That's what we're talking about here. Well, if we're talking about history, his story, don't you think we ought to get all the facts out on the table? If there is no God and we evolved, and that's the official doctrine of public school, then don't you think we ought to abolish Thanksgiving and Christmas and Easter? What the hell has that got to do with the price of putty anywhere? If, on the other hand, there was a resurrection for which you're claiming that you're celebrating Easter, and if there was a birth of God, Jesus, and he was a part of divinity or the divine creation, and we're giving thanks to him on Thanksgiving, don't you think we ought to talk a little bit more about that in our history textbooks? A little something about Genesis 1, 2, and 3, and maybe a little about Genesis 6, 7, and 8, and maybe a little bit about Exodus 1, 2, and 3, and, you know, just throwing a little spice for the mix. You don't find that, but I just thought I'd throw that out there. Now, in talking about the history of Thanksgiving, which is a religious holiday, by the way, the true history of Thanksgiving reveals embarrassing facts. I'm going to underline, it reveals embarrassing facts. That is the true history of Thanksgiving. You see, the pilgrims did not introduce the tradition. Eastern Indians had observed autumnal harvest celebrations for centuries. And although George Washington did set aside days for national Thanksgiving, our modern celebrations date back only to 1863. So the Thanksgiving, in this modern form, dates back to 1863, during the Civil War, when the Union needed all of the patriotism that such an observance might muster. Abraham Lincoln proclaimed Thanksgiving a national holiday. The Pilgrims had absolutely nothing to do with it, and not until the 1890s did they even get included in the tradition. So, you know, from 1863 to 1890, the Pilgrims were not included in the Thanksgiving history story. Did you know that? That is, for the first 30 years of the program. Now, if you didn't know that, how come? What's the purpose behind teaching us that the Pilgrims celebrated the first Thanksgiving? Huh? What the hell has that got to do with the price of putty? Not that the Pilgrims weren't nice guys, and not that the Pilgrims didn't do a valuable service, and not that they ought not to be recognized for their historical contribution to the world, but why shouldn't we just look at the Pilgrims for what they did and not give them a lot of credit for things that they didn't do and had no part in? And then ask questions like, what in the hell has this Thanksgiving and Pilgrims got to do with Thanksgiving and patriotism during the Civil War? What's that got to do with the war effort? Now, the ideological meaning American history has ascribed to Thanksgiving compounds the embarrassment. So it's an ideological meaning. And the Thanksgiving legend makes Americans ethnocentric. After all, if our culture has God on its side, why should we consider other cultures seriously? This ethnocentrism intensified in the middle of the last century in Race and Manifest Destiny. That's a book, by the way, called Race and Manifest Destiny. Reginald Horseman has shown how the idea of God on our side was used to legitimate the open expression of Anglo-Saxon superiority vis-a-vis Mexicans, Native Americans, and peoples of the Pacific, Jews, and Catholics. Today, when textbooks promote this ethnocentrism with their pilgrim stories, they leave students less able to learn from the deal with and to deal with other people from other cultures. Now, on occasion, we pay a more direct cost. It's called censorship. Can you say censorship, boys and girls? Well, for instance, back in 1970, for example, the Massachusetts Department of Commerce asked the Wampanoags Indians to select a speaker to mark the 350th anniversary of the Pilgrims' Landing. So a fellow by the name of Frank James, who is a descendant of the Wampanoags Indians, was selected. But first, he had to show a copy of his speech to the white people who were in charge of the ceremony. And when the white people, that is the committee from the Department of Commerce of Massachusetts, when they saw what this American Indian had written, they would not allow him to read it. Now, wait a minute here. Hang on. Hold it. Hold it a second. You got a Thanksgiving celebration coming up in Massachusetts, which makes all the sense in the world, because that's where the Pilgrims landed, remember, at Plymouth Rock in Massachusetts? All right. And the Pilgrims now are the beginning of the first Thanksgiving. And you remember the story, they sat down with the Indians, and the Indians were having Thanksgiving dinner with them. Okay. You remember that? All right. Well, it makes a lot of sense then. You know, the Americans, the white men, who run the government of Massachusetts, the Department of Commerce of Massachusetts. And they said, hey, we're going to have a big Thanksgiving celebration over here. Wouldn't it be kind of good if we had an American Indian deliver the keynote address? Kind of like having Barack Obama, a black American, speak before this group on the subject of race and race relations. Just makes all the sense in the world. And so, what would you think if Barack Obama got up there and the whites in charge of it said, now, wait a minute, Mr. Obama, we need to read your speech first and determine whether or not we're going to approve of what you're going to say. You know, our First Amendment in our Constitution talks a lot about freedom of speech, free speech. I mean, I might not like what Obama's going to say, but, you know, if in the spirit of free speech, if I'm going to have free speech and I'm going to be able to come on the radio and say what I want to say, well, then shouldn't other people that have a different opinion have the right to get on the air and call me a liar and a thief and all kinds of other dirty low-down names and tell everybody how stupid and how demoralizing and dumb I am, even whether it's true or false? And I'm all in favor of free speech, and I think that that's true. I think they ought to have that right, and they do. I get emails in here all the time, and people tell me what they think of me. And I think that you have a right to do that. That's what free speech is all about. That, you know, you people are wrong, and it's not true when you write your nasty, barbed emails to me and tell me, you know, how stupid I am. That's not true. But you certainly have a right to believe it, and you certainly have a right to say it. Now, what if I said, wait a minute, that's hate speech. I'm going to go to the legislature and have a law passed. And anybody that writes a nasty letter to George Gordon is going to be arrested and jailed. What would you think of that? Well, you'd think, well, that isn't free speech. And that's censorship. And that guy Gordon and the legislature, they're ganging up in a conspiracy, and they're not letting us tell the truth. Well, you know, tell the truth as you see it. Because, see, us white guys over here, we're telling the truth as we see it. The only problem is that, hell, even us whites know it ain't the truth. And so what would be wrong if we just actually got up in front of everybody and said, hey, why don't you bring an Indian in here and let him tell us from his point of view what he thinks of Thanksgiving. Let's let the Indians tell us what they think about Columbus. I know it's a wild new concept over here, but and it's probably a bunch of lies. I mean, after all, what would these American Indians know about Columbus and Thanksgiving? I mean, that we don't already know. I mean, we're the guys that write the textbooks and the history books, don't we? All right, so going on here, here's what James had written. Now, this guy, his name is Frank James. He's an American Indian. And they would not let him say this to all of the people gathered and assembled there. They practiced censorship on him. So I'm going to tell you what this American Indian had to say about Thanksgiving. He said, quote, today is a time of celebrating for you, but it is not a time of celebrating for me. It is with a heavy heart that I look back upon what happened to my people. The pilgrims had hardly explored the shores of Cape Cod 4 days before they had robbed the graves of my ancestors and stolen their corn, wheat, and beans. Massasoit, the great leader of the Wampanoag, knew these facts, and yet he and his people welcomed and befriended those settlers, little knowing that before 50 years were to pass, the Wampanoags and other Indians living near the settlers would be killed by their guns or would be killed from their diseases that we caught from them. And although our way of life is now almost gone and our language is almost extinct, we, the Wampanoags, still walk the lands of Massachusetts. And what has happened cannot be changed, but today we work toward a better America, a more Indian America, where people and nature once again are important. Unquote. Very short, direct address by an American Indian who was slated, who was asked to speak back in 1970. You know, fairly modern times. And what the Massachusetts Department of Commerce censored was not some incendiary falsehood, but rather it was the historical truth. There wasn't anything that James would have said in that speech, if he had been allowed to speak, which he was not, which would have been false except the word wheat, W-H-E-A-T. He used the word wheat. That was false. It wasn't wheat, it was some other grain. Our textbooks also omit the facts about grave robbing, Indian enslavement, the plague, and more. And even though they were common knowledge in colonial New England, for at least a century, Puritan ministers thundered their interpretation of the meaning of the plague from New England pulpits. Thus, our popular history of the pilgrims has not been a process of gaining perspective, but rather, it is a process of deliberate forgetting. Instead of these important facts, textbooks supply the feel-good of Squanto's helpfulness, Squanto's name, the fish in the cornhills, and sometimes even the menu and the number of Indians who attended this protypical first Thanksgiving in 1621. Which is a pure fiction. Now, I have focused here on untoward detail only because our histories have suppressed everything awkward for so long. You see, the pilgrims' courage in setting forth in the late fall to make their way on a continent new to them remains unsurpassed. They were heroes. In their first year, the pilgrims, like the Indians, suffered from diseases, including scurvy and pneumonia. Half of them died. Half of the pilgrims died that first year. It was not immoral of the pilgrims to have taken over Pawtucketts. They did not cause the plague that killed the Indians by disease, and they were just as baffled as to its origin as the stricken Indian villagers. Massasoit, the Indian chief, was happy that the pilgrims were using the bay for the Pawtucketts being dead have no more need for the site. This word is P-A-T-U-X-E-T. That's the name of the Indian village. Pawtucket, I guess it is. Pawtucket. Because they had no more need for the site. The Pilgrim-Indian relations started reasonably positively. Plymouth, unlike many other colonies, usually paid the Indians for the land that they took. In some instances, the Europeans settled in Indian towns because Indians had invited them there as protection against another tribe or a nearby competing European power. In some, U.S. history is no more violent and oppressive than the history of England, Russia, Indonesia, or Burundi, but neither is it exceptionally less violent. The antidote to feel-good history is not feel-bad history. but rather honest and inclusive history. If textbook authors feel compelled to give moral instruction the way origin myths have always done, they could accomplish this aim by allowing students to learn both the good and the bad sides of the pilgrim tale. Conflict would then become part of the story, and students might discover that the knowledge they gain has implications for their lives today. Correctly taught, the issues of the era of the first Thanksgiving could help Americans grow more thoughtful and more tolerant rather than more ethnocentric. Origin myths do not come cheaply. To glorify the pilgrims is dangerous. The genial omissions and the invented details with which our textbooks retail the pilgrim archetype are close cousins of the overt censorship practiced by the Massachusetts Department of Commerce in denying Frank James the right to speak. Surely in history, truth should be held sacred at whatever cost. All right, so what's the lesson to be learned? Political correctness creates a diminution or a destruction of your freedom of speech. See, here in Canada, in Germany, for instance, you have what's called hate crimes. We're about to enact that kind of legislation here in America. And the minute that you do that, you destroy free speech. In the interest of political correctness, in the interest of these lies, we create groupthink for the purpose of destroying freedom of speech. That's the purpose for it. That's where you're headed. And the day will come when, like this guy, Frank James, you will not be able to speak the truth. Well, you know, the truth as you see it, which may be a bald-faced lie. But you see, any time the Catholics get control of the legislature, they will see history from their perspective. And when the Protestants get control of the legislature, they will see history from their perspective. It would be better if we just told the truth about the Catholics and the Protestants. Just lay it out. Don't embellish it. Don't try to make it look better for the Catholics, all you Catholics out there. Just go ahead and tell us what did you really do? What was your intentions? How did it work and why? And you Protestants out there, just do the same thing. And you American Indians, just stand right up there and tell us, you know, from your point of view, what happened. And then we'll do the same thing. And there will be discrepancies in the stories. And then let us sort out those discrepancies. Let's take a look at witnesses, evidence, and testimony so that those of us that are interested in the truth can see it for what it is. And then make our decisions based upon real facts. As an illustration, what we're seeing and what we're hearing concerning the Wall Street bailout of these companies, these AIG and so on, they're all lies. And hell, I think most of us know they're lies. We don't know what the lies are, and we don't know what the truth is, but we do know that they're lying to us. We just don't know what they're lying to us about. And this is at some point in time going to be written up in our histories, just like the Great Depression of the 1920s. It's all been written up. And there's some true history of it, and there's some false history of it. And we throw that out there into the mix. The truth is out there for everybody to see. I told you about this guy, Smedley Butler. He's there to tell you about the Wall Street role in history, about what the American military forces are really there for. They're not there to protect the American people from the Russians or the Chinese. Hell, we're in business. We're in bed with the Russians and Chinese. So if you think that you're spending $500 billion a year on nuclear submarines and SAC bombers and nuclear missiles to protect you from a foreign invasion, you got your head up the wrong end. That doesn't have any semblance of truth behind it. The $500 billion a year that we're spending on national defense is the arm of American business. And it's out in the world enforcing American commercial interests worldwide. in 154 countries with 731 military bases. That's what it's there for. Now, is that good public policy? I don't know. Well, I'm not here to second-guess George Bush and the American Empire. Is the war in Iraq good foreign policy? I don't know. I'm not here to criticize the Republicans or the Democrats or Harry Reid or concerning their views on the war. I just like the facts to be put out in front of everybody, and then, hell, you can decide for yourself. Do you think that we Americans need more oil and that we need to take it away from the Iraqis? If you think that's correct, then, hell, the war is out there for everybody to see. But don't you think we ought to just stand up and say, no, look, you Iraqis over there, it's nothing personal. This is just an extension of the American empire. Sit back and relax. It's going to be good for you. You're going to love it. All right, we're at the halfway point. Let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about the law school and the law hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, or they could be political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, the beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Again, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about Lies My Teacher Told Me. It's written by a fellow by the name of James W. Lowen, L-O-E-W-E-N. Pretty big, thick book here. Pretty thick, big book. It's 372 pages total, including the index and all the rest of the information that goes with it. About 350 pages of good reading, historical documentation of a lot of the things that you believe, then you're going to read this book and find out that those aren't true, that they're lies. Now, these lies are very important for the political establishment, because in order to get you people to go along with this war in Iraq, we had to get you into a mindset first, to get you to go into a war against Osama bin Laden and the terrorists in Afghanistan and the Taliban and so on. We have to have a mindset, and we create that through groupthink, and we create that by giving you historical falsehoods. We're going to paint a picture like Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, which is totally fictitious, but which you're going to believe, and you're going to act upon it. And by doing that, we can get you people to pay tax, to support things that you ordinarily wouldn't support, to believe things that you wouldn't normally believe. We can get you, in short, to believe in lies. That the war in Iraq is fought for the purpose of bringing democracy to the downtrodden masses of Iraqis who were exploited by a horrible dictator named Saddam Hussein. You know, a lot of people believe that. Or that we're fighting in Iraq because we want to make the Middle East safe for democracy, for everybody. Isn't that sweet? That's a lie. That's not true at all. Doesn't have any basis in historical fact or in political fact. But, you know, a lot of people believe that. Now, in order to get you people to believe these things, then we have to start you off on a group think program. We call this public school. It's the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto. It's the exact opposite from what our founding fathers experienced. None of them went to PS 235 in New York City. Not a single one of them ever went to public school. They were all educated men, and they could all read and write. And they didn't go to public school to learn it. So that should tell you that people could learn to read and write without public school. In a long time before public schools ever came on the scene here in America, and a long time before we adopted the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto, we were educating people here. Americans were not a bunch of ignorant savages dragging their knuckles on the ground in Baltimore and New York and Los Angeles in 1830 or 1850. Now, we would like to think that because we have disciplines like archaeology and they're running around digging up ancient old sites and then they tell us lies about the people that lived there. Now, we have a mindset here in America that the reason that we're spending $500 billion a year on national defense is to protect us from the Russians and Chinese. We Americans are now spending more money on the military than all the rest of the countries in the world combined. You take all of the military expenditures of Russia and China and Bolivia and Great Britain and France and Germany, and Indonesia, and Vietnam, and Japan, and China. I mean, just lump everybody in the world together. And they're not spending as much on military armament and hardware as we Americans are. And in order to get us to do that and to believe in that, we have to believe that there's an enemy out there. And the current enemy are terrorists. You don't see the Chinese and the Russians and everybody else in the world spending $500 billion a year protecting themselves from terrorists. You don't see the Swedes and the Norwegians and the Finns and the Danes spending billions of dollars putting in missile defense shields against Iranian missiles raining down on Copenhagen or Stockholm or Oslo, Norway. It's the Americans that are doing that. Americans are putting up missile shields in Poland and Czechoslovakia to protect us from Iranian missiles, which the American intelligence tells you plainly there isn't a missile in Iran that can reach anywhere in the United States or Canada or Australia. But they say, well, they can reach Poland and Czechoslovakia. The Russians aren't building a missile defense shield against Iranian attack. The Russians are not concerned about the Iranians' nuclear capabilities. Chinese aren't. Brazilians aren't. Then what's this preoccupation that we Americans have with this Iranian nuclear threat or the North Korean nuclear threat? Are the Chinese and the Russians and the Brazilians concerned about it? Are they gearing up and spending $500 billion a year to protect themselves against the axis of evil? All right, but we Americans are. And we Americans have a mindset. Honest to God, we believe that if we do not spend $500 billion a year, the Chinese will come to our shores on the Pacific coast and invade our country. Well, I told you about this guy, Smedley Butler. Now, he's a 3-star Marine general, and he had a chapter in his book called War is a Racket. He wrote in 1932, because back in the 1930s, you see, people were afraid that the Germans and the Japanese were going to do just that. There was a mindset in America when I was a child that the Japanese were going to attack the west coast of the United States with troops. All right, that was a fiction. The Japanese weren't ever going to attack and invade the west coast of the United States. And that's because they couldn't do it. And they didn't attack the Hawaiian Islands. Not because they couldn't, but because it was too far. Yeah, Smedley Butler pointed this out. He said, if the Germans were going to launch an attack against the United States of America, an amphibious attack, the Germans did not have the capability of launching an amphibious attack against England just 20 miles across the channel in 1940. They couldn't do it. Well, then what in the hell made you Americans think that the Germans were going to launch an amphibious attack against the Atlantic, against New York or New Jersey? You were preparing for it in World War II. Did you know that? See, the Japanese did in fact have amphibious forces, and they did attack the Philippines. They did attack Indonesia. They did attack certain islands. But Smedley Butler put the thing in perspective. He said, every time that you run your ship 1 mile away from your base of supply, just 1 mile, you've got to have 3 miles behind that of supplies to extend it 1 mile. So all you need to do is to figure out how many miles is it from Japan, their farthest forward base. How far forward are they? And then look back 3 times and then calculate how much they've got behind them, and that'll tell you how far forward they can move. I didn't know that until I read Smedley's book on War as a Racket. See, I'm not a military man. Hell, I don't know that. I'm a plumber. What in the hell would I know about amphibious attack? But hey, all of you soldiers out there, all of you Navy people, all of you people listening to me, you've been through West Point. You've been through Annapolis. You know as well as I do that today, in the year 2008, that the Chinese and the Russians cannot mount an amphibious attack against the United States of America. Neither one of them, both of them together, can't do that. They haven't got the military forces to do that. They haven't got the ships. They haven't got the supplies. They haven't got the money. They haven't got the material. Can't do it. So we Americans can sit over here in North America, give them all the finger. And that's what Butler said. In his book, he said, America's military forces should be limited to 200 miles within our borders. That is, our American fleets, all of our aircraft carriers and all the rest of it, should be steaming up and down the American coasts, both of them, all three of them. Yeah, three, got the Gulf of Mexico. We should be steaming around within 200 miles of our coasts and telling everybody, butt out and stay away. We don't. We have 6 aircraft carrier task forces in the Persian Gulf steaming up and down outside the borders of Iran this morning. Well, you know, those Iranians over there are kind of nervous about that, and so are the Russians. Now, there isn't any reason for us Americans to be nervous about the Russians. The Russians are going to have some naval exercises off the coast of Venezuela. What they're doing is sending us a message. Hey, how do you like having Russian ships in your backyard? Well, that's how we feel you putting American ships in our backyard. All right. So I just thought I'd point that out to you that, you know, we're sitting on the bar stool and we're goading these Russians, and there's a reason for it. The American government wants to start World War III, and there's only two potential protagonists, Russia and China. I mean, trying to goad the Brazilians into World War III, or the Indians, or the Japanese, or the Vietnamese, or something, you know, that's kind of ludicrous. I mean, hell, even you Americans wouldn't believe that. Even Mr. Rogers couldn't sell that. So what we got to do is we've got to create an incident. Now, we can't attack Russia, but what we need to do is to create incidents for which the Russians are going to overreact, so that we can then come back and say, well, see, look what these Russians have done now. We were not going to sit still for that. And that's because America needs war. The Russians don't need it. Their economy is flourishing. It's vibrant. The Chinese don't need war. Their economy is flourishing, and it's vibrant. The people who need war are the people whose economies are collapsing, whose economies are not vibrant. And as a distraction and as a stimulus to their economies, they need war. That's why we needed World War II. World War II was the stimulus that brought us out of the Great Depression of the 1930s. We needed World War II. We placed an embargo against the Japanese oil imports from Indonesia. Did you know that? 1937, President Roosevelt teamed up with the Dutch, and they stopped selling oil to the Japanese. 1937. Okay. I'm not here to second-guess foreign policy. Hell, probably a great idea. Well, let's put the shoe on the other foot. Let's suppose that the Russians team up with the Venezuelans and impose an oil embargo against the United States, where we get about 15% of the oil that we import into the United States comes from Venezuela. Let's suppose that the Venezuelans shut our oil off. What do you think the results of that's going to be? I will guarantee you war in the morning. And if not in the morning, within a week. So that isn't going to happen. And this Hugo Chavez, you know, he's a communist, and he's jumping up and down. He's rattling his sabers, and he's threatened to shut off oil to the United States. That isn't going to happen. I can guarantee that ain't going to happen. Well, not unless the guy wakes up demented in the morning, you know. I guess anything's possible. Now, everybody knows very well that the Americans are very violent, very aggressive people. I mean, Americans don't know that. But everybody else out there in the world knows that. Hell, the Vietnamese know that. The Koreans know that. The Russians and Chinese know that. The only people that don't know how violent Americans are the Americans. I mean, it's the Americans that invaded Haiti, Nicaragua, and Mexico. It's not the Mexicans that are invading the United States. The last Mexican invasion force was Santa Anna in 1836. It is true that the Mexicans have had a history of invading the United States. Well, you know, from our perspective in history, when Santa Anna invaded the United States, he was here to protect his piece of real estate called Texas. Did you boys and girls know that Texas at one time was a part of Mexico? And in 1820, a bunch of Americans, you know, a bunch of white people, went down to Texas at the invitation of the Mexican government to colonize Texas. They wanted to develop it. And they said, well, come on in, you Americans, you white people, and colonize Texas. It's kind of like the Mexicans are just doing it by reverse. They're coming across the border, and they're colonizing America. And the day is coming when they're going to take over America, just like the whites in Texas took Texas over from the Mexicans. This is not an accident. This immigration policy that's going on in America is not an accident. It's a design. It's the purpose. There's a purpose behind it. What's going to happen? The ultimate end of this is that the Mexicans are going to take over Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, and California. And perhaps as far north as Colorado and annex that to Mexico. And then all of you whites down there in that region of the southwestern United States are going to have an opportunity to see historically what it means to be ruled over by a bunch of people that are not, you know, of your same race and ethnicity. I mean, that's what we did to the Mexicans, and the Mexicans are just doing back to us what we did to them in Texas. It's nothing new. Hell, it's been going on for a long time, thousands of years. So I just thought I'd bring that to your attention. Now, historically, Americans are in the dark. Americans cannot see what's happening to them in the southwestern United States. I wanted you to know that California and Texas are now minority white. Did you know that? Yeah, there's more others living there than whites now. Now, Smedley Butler pointed out that there's no invasion threat coming from Europe against the United States. It is physically too far. And so he works it out, and he says, here's how many invasion ships an invading army would have to come against the United States in the 1930s with a population of 150 million. They would have to have a fleet of some 12,000 ships, the Americans, with an invasion force, attack the Philippines with 4,000 ships. 4,000. The Germans didn't have 12,000 ships to invade the United States, and neither did the Japanese. So Butler, who's a three-star general, said all of this hoopla about an invasion coming from Germany or Japan against the United States is nonsense. And Butler said, if Germany and Japan can conquer all the rest of the world, all we need is to keep the Monroe Doctrine, mind our own business, and live our lives right here in North and South America, and the Germans and Japanese, and after they've conquered the Russians and Chinese and everybody else in the world, cannot attack the United States successfully. He said that in the 1930s, and gives you the numbers to back it up. Now, I know that all of us believe that that's not true, and that we're under immediate threat of attack from the Chinese and the Russians. Well, you can believe that if you want to. It ain't true. It isn't historically true. It never has been, isn't now. Now, the Russians and Chinese have every reason to believe that the Americans would attack Russia and China. We've done it in the past. We are right now engaged in an encircling program, which includes Kosovo and Georgia, and we're actively goading both of those nations into war. So far, they haven't taken the bait. Now, the Japanese took the bait. They didn't take the bait in 1937, 38, 39, but by 1941, they'd had enough of this American imperialism. They said, enough's enough, and they attacked us. They took the bait. That's what the Americans wanted. They wanted the Japs to take the bait. So when the Japs struck the first blow at Pearl Harbor, then our president said, look what these dirty suckers have done. Are we going to let them get away with that? Hell no. And the fight's on. All right, so that gives you a little history as to what the lies my teacher told us is all about. Written by James W. Loewen, L-O-E-W-E-N. Probably get a copy at Barnes & Noble. I don't know what the price is. I got $7 here. I think I bought this used in a bookstore for $7. It's probably going to cost you $25. I got the paperback edition. We'll take a look at more of Lies My Teacher Told Me next time here on the Law Hour, an editorial review. Meanwhile, I'm out of time. I got to give you a final reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the internet and radio worldwide. Now, for more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. The website is georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, our time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.